From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The relationship between the U.S. and Russia seems to have reached a low point, with evidence that Russia may have meddled in our presidential election on behalf of Donald Trump. Trump is a longtime admirer of Putin and promises that he would keep the Russian president in check. It's a bold claim. This hour on Point, the rocky U.S.-Russia relationship, and exactly what threat Russia poses to the United States today. You can join us on air or online. Do you consider Russia a threat today? If so, how serious and what kind? What do you make of the DNC email hack possibly conducted by Russia, or of Donald Trump's supportive statements about Vladimir Putin? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from New York is Cameron Abadi. He's a senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He's been following the latest on current events in Russia related to the United States. And Cameron, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us also from Nantucket, Massachusetts, is Angela Stent. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela Stent, welcome to you also to On Point.
Good to be on the show.
So I want sort of to talk about how we got to where we are. How did we get to a point where we seem to largely have written off Russia as an older, outdated Cold War enemy, and suddenly we have some analysts saying that the Cold War is alive and well? And I think a good way to do that may be to talk about some of the things that have happened lately. Let's start with Trump's comments about Ukraine, about the situation in Crimea. And let's do that by listening to a piece of sound in which, in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos that aired on Sunday, Trump said that Russian President Vladimir Putin won't make a military move into Ukraine. Of course, that appears to have missed the fact that Putin has already done that. He sees the country's Crimean peninsula. Here's that exchange with Stephanopoulos.
They took away the part of the platform calling for provision of lethal weapons to Ukraine to defend themselves. Why is that a good idea?
I have my own ideas. He's not going into Ukraine, okay? Just so you understand. He's not going to go into Ukraine. All right, you can mark it down, you can put it down, you can take it anywhere
you want.
Well,
he's already there, isn't he?
Okay. Well, he's there in a certain way, but I'm not there. You have Obama there.
Cameron Abadi, what do you make of that exchange?
Well, as you pointed out, the first thing to point out is that it's not clear if Trump has his facts straight. He suggested that Putin is not yet in Ukraine when, in fact, there's a war ongoing right now as we speak. So that's just a factual basis on which to question Mr. Trump. The other question is about specifically Crimea, where he where Trump suggested a new policy, which is to recognize Russia's seizure of that area of Ukraine. That was the real pivot point where Russia went, where the relationship with Russia became much more hostile.
And remind us briefly what happened there. We're talking about this 2014 annexation. Just bring us up to speed on that. Remind us of that.
Absolutely. So Ukraine deposed its president in a revolution, in a peaceful revolution, and Vladimir Putin thought that this was a threat to Russia, which he previously had very close ties with Ukraine, and so he sent military Russian military soldiers into Crimea, seized that territory, staged a referendum, and declared it part of Russia. The rest of the world has not recognized that seizure of and that redrawing of boundaries. But Trump seems to be prepared to consider it, and that would be a real shift in policy and a real shift in norms of international relations.
And Angela Stent of Georgetown and the Brookings Institution, would you weigh in on that? What do you make of Donald Trump weighing in this way on this issue?
Well, I think the most charitable explanation could be that what he was trying to say is if he had been president, Russia wouldn't have gone into Ukraine, or if he were president, it wouldn't go into Ukraine again. I mean, we can certainly question that. But I think I was at a conference last year in Kiev, international conference, where they beamed in Donald Trump from his home in New York, and he said to the assembled Ukrainians and international guests, I love the Ukraine, which one doesn't normally say it's Ukraine, and sort of said some very complimentary things about Ukraine. I think it's possible that he either doesn't really know what happened, or again, he loves to praise Putin, but then he also likes to show that he would be strong, and so he's saying this wouldn't happen under my watch.
We should also point out that a lot of this talk makes the former Soviet republics quite uneasy. You know, when they see a possible alliance between Putin and Trump, and they see the land grab, the power grab that Russia did in 2014, it makes them uneasy considering Soviet history.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, obviously, the Ukrainians are very, very concerned about this, but so are the Georgians, so are a number of the other post-Soviet states, because they believe that were Trump to become president, President Putin would feel that he had a free hand to do whatever he wanted. And Russia is already pursuing a policy of, you know, destabilizing whatever it can in its neighborhood and making sure that none of these countries will look west again.
All right. So we have the situation involving Ukraine and Crimea. Another issue that has Russia very much on the top of the radar for the United States is this DNC hacking. So let's listen to the press conference last week in which Donald Trump invited Russia to hack the private email server that Hillary Clinton used when she was Secretary of State.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
Cameron Abadi of Foreign Policy Magazine, do you think there are various ways to interpret that?
Well, I think we could take Trump's own interpretation afterwards, in which he said that it was simply a joke. He was being sarcastic in inviting Russia to do such a thing. But even that's worth thinking about, whether that's how useful an interpretation that is, because this is a very serious matter that occurred where Russia seems to have hacked the DNC emails. And this is a national security issue. And for Trump to make a joke about that is itself a question of his judgment. And so, yeah, this is you know, I'm not sure how far he gets by saying it's a joke.
Angela Stent?
Well, I agree. I mean, to invite a foreign power to commit cybercrime against your own country, even if it's a quote-unquote joke, I mean, it seems to be extremely irresponsible. So I think you just have to question who in this country would this kind of rhetoric appeal to, and apparently there's some people to whom it does appeal, but this is obviously very serious.
Another issue here is that Trump's talk about Russia is quite a different position largely than the Obama administration has taken towards Russia, and that if the Clinton administration were in place, said it would take toward Russia. Give us a little sense, Cameron Abadi, of how Trump's policy, what he says would be his policy, differs from what U.S. policy now is toward Russia.
Well, there are some very basic and fundamental differences. One is, let's take NATO as a military alliance that partly protects European countries from the threat of Russia. That has been a mainstay of U.S. policy since the Second World War, and Donald Trump has said he may consider either abdicating or breaking up NATO or not taking part in NATO or not fulfilling American responsibilities in protecting those countries. So that's a pretty fundamental difference. Otherwise, the recognition of Crimea is a major issue. Generally praising Putin's violations of human rights norms in Russia, rather than criticizing Putin's lack of democracy in Russia, Trump seems to be willing to praise it as a strong leader of the Russian country. So these are all pretty big changes in terms of how to approach and deal with the country.
Angela Stent, we have Hillary Clinton distancing herself from Russia and staying with the more of the approach of isolating Russia. We have Trump saying he would try to restore relations. On the other hand, we have John Kerry, the Secretary of State, working with Russia to try to figure out this terrible situation in Syria. So it seems like even within the U.S. administration, there's a little split on the best way to deal with this country.
Well, I mean, we do know that there are disagreements within the U.S. government about how much of a threat Russia poses and how to deal with it. Certainly, Secretary Kerry has put an enormous amount of time and effort to trying to work out something on Syria with Russia. We've had apparently a leaked document that came out in the Washington Post showing that the U.S. was going to go quite far in trying to secure Russian cooperation for dealing with Assad and for dealing with Islamic State and for providing humanitarian help, which would mean that we would actually share quite a lot more information with the Russians than we have so far. Now, none of that has happened yet, but he's pursuing that very doggedly. And then on another track, although we're not the prime movers in trying to resolve the Ukraine crisis, there's something called the Minsk Agreement where Germany is the lead, but we're still backing out that. We're sending our Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, to talk to the Russians. So on both of the, and Kerry himself is discussing this with Lavrov. So we're trying to resolve these issues with Russia, but that's really different from saying, as Trump has said, you know, I'm going to go and sit down and do a deal with him. And we can, you know, if we listen to what he said, what you were playing, part of the deal would be we recognize Crimea, you know, and then we get on with it. So, but I, and then there are others within our own administration, I think, who take a much more wary attitude towards dealing with Russia and who really don't believe it's possible to cooperate in any meaningful way with the current administration in the Kremlin.
Angela Sten, you have said, I believe, that U.S.-Russia relations are worse than at any point since the Gorbachev era. And Cameron Abadi, there was a CEO of a cybersecurity firm who recently spoke to the publication Defense One and said the Cold War is alive and well. Do you think that's hyperbole, Cameron, or do you think that's fair?
Well, to put it in terms of the Cold War, that I'd say it's perhaps an exaggeration, but it is to say it's worse than any time since the Cold War, I think, sounds entirely fair. It's worth remembering just 4 years ago what the rhetoric about Russia was. We had Mitt Romney at the time was the Republican nominee, and he suggested at that time that Russia was the number one geopolitical foe of the United States. That was a claim that was widely mocked by analysts, not just in the Democratic Party, but by independent observers. So, and that, now we have quite the opposite. Most analysts suggesting that Donald Trump, that Russia is a major threat indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're looking at the rocky U.S.-Russia relationship and how we got here. You can join this conversation. Let us know if you think the U.S.-Russian relationship has reached a unique low and what threat, if any, you think Russia poses to the U.S. We're talking with Cameron Abadi, a senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine, and also with Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. And Cameron and Angela, I want to go to another piece of sound. This one goes back about 4 years to the October 2012 presidential debate with Mitt Romney, in which President Obama essentially downplayed the threat of Russia. And he said that Romney's focus on Russia didn't really reflect an understanding of the current threats to the United States. Here that is.
A few months ago, when you were asked what's the biggest geopolitical threat facing America, you said Russia. Not Al-Qaeda. You said Russia. In the 1980s are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years.
Angela Stent, was Obama too quick there to write off the threat that Russia poses in this day and age?
Well, I think on the one hand, he was right to say that, you know, Islamic State and affiliated groups probably are the single most important threat. But of course, things have changed since then. And Russia is now using rhetoric about the possibility of limited nuclear war very seriously. They've been buzzing our allies' planes and our own planes sometimes in their vicinity. They have taken a much more aggressive military stance towards the United States. So, and I think the other thing is, you know, I do believe, by the way, that we are in sort of Cold War 2.0. It's different from the initial Cold War. But we are by now also ideological antagonists. Russia sees the United States as its number one enemy. It's in all of its foreign policy and military doctrines, the United States and NATO. We don't see Russia as our number one enemy, but they certainly see us as such. And that you can see, you know, in most places around the world, they're trying to undermine our interests and certainly profit from the tensions that exist within the Atlantic Alliance, within NATO, between the different European countries and the United States. So Russia is playing a different role now than it was during that presidential debate.
And Cold War 2.0, I think in part, is sort of the weaponizing of information. You know, we're looking at cyber warfare, not just conventional warfare. You know, on the other hand, last month, The Nation had a piece saying that there are many people in NATO that believe that a major war with Russia could actually be possible and that they've conducted war games in preparation. So on one hand, the U.S. has to focus on terrorism and cybersecurity, but also have the awareness that we have to stay prepared for conventional warfare. So, Cameron Abadi, how do you think, for example, we compare the threat that Russia poses to the threat that the Islamic State poses? They're very different. One much more outwardly, overtly focused on terrorism, one more meddling in terms of cyber warfare. How do we compare these?
Well, I think it's partly a matter of about a time perspective. There's short-term threats, immediate threats that are of violence and terrorism, and then there are medium-term threats posed by a major state like Russia in terms of the power it has by having so much territory and bordering so many other countries. And it has the wealth and the diplomatic resources and the technological resources to really pose a longer-term challenge than something like the Islamic State, which is struggling to maintain territory and can organize attacks. But in terms of a longer-term threat, it's not clear if it can even survive. Russia will certainly survive.
Angela Stent?
I would agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, the most important issue between the U.S. and Russia has always been that we are the two nuclear superpowers in the world with the power to destroy not only each other, but other countries. So managing that relationship has always been the essence of what we do. I mean, at the moment, that relationship is still managed. But if you look again at some of the things the Russians say and do and some of their posture, then I think you do have to believe that longer term, you know, this is still a major threat. Now, to go back to what President Obama was saying in that 2012 debate and also what he was quoted as saying in the Atlantic Monthly a few months ago in an article, he sees Russia as a declining power. It certainly is in terms of its economy. It's not modernizing its society. It's falling further and further behind in many of those ways. But it still has, a large nuclear arsenal and a beefed up military. It's been working on reviving and improving its military. And therefore, it's the combination of a country that is in many ways in secular kind of demographic and economic decline, but still has these weapons that makes one realize you have to think very carefully about, in the longer term, what that might do and what kind of actions Russia could take.
And so, and for that reason, it's very important that the U.S. have it remains an important relationship that the U.S. needs to have with Russia, and it needs to figure out what should that relationship be. That's why the issue of what is the relationship between Putin and Trump has become so interesting. So let's listen to Putin in December talking to reporters about Donald Trump and essentially praising him. He says he's a very bright person, talented without any doubt. It is not our business to assess his worthiness, but he is absolutely the leader of the presidential race. And now we have some sound. This is also in the interview that Trump did with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday on ABC's This Week. This is responding to questions about his relationship with Putin, who he's paid many compliments to over the year.
If our country got along with Russia, that would be a great thing. When Putin goes out and tells everybody, and you talk about relationship, but he says Donald Trump is going to win and Donald Trump is a genius, and then I have people saying you should disavow. I said, I'm going to disavow that. But when Putin says good things and when we have a possibility of having a good relationship with Russia, I think that's good.
Cameron Abadi, on the face of it, that is not unreasonable. Isn't it better to have a good relationship with Russia than a bad one? And if so, why are people so nervous about this?
Having a good relationship is a certainly positive thing, but to have to be in the position of weakness is another. And I think there's certainly circumstantial evidence to suggest that Vladimir Putin would like Donald Trump to win. The problem is that that may be because he sees Donald Trump as somebody who he can manipulate, somebody who would actually be more weak in leading American foreign policy. And so that is the question. Donald Trump thinks he can maintain a good relationship, but we don't exactly know what's going on in Vladimir Putin's head. He uses kind words, but he may be thinking that Trump is pliable.
Let's bring in a caller who wants to weigh in on this. This is Jamal calling from Detroit, Michigan. Jamal, welcome to On Point. What are your thoughts on this?
Hello. My points are this. I think we are having a problem with Russia, and in particular for two reasons. One, of their making, one of our own. One, if we're going to be blunt, Russia never really matters on the global stage unless it involves their military. Not their economy, not their culture, not their global leadership. It's always the fear of Russian troops crossing borders. That's how they get people to notice them. The second part is of our own making, and, you know, fair or unfair. After the wars that W started, George W. Bush, Obama has been, you know, he has not wanted to engage in anything. And I think that's emboldened other places and Putin to test things. And if best case scenario, a skirmish or a war starts off and the price of oil goes up, that benefits their economy.
Interesting. Angela Stent, you want to respond to that?
Well, I would just say that, of course, President Obama did engage with Russia in his first term, that we had a reset policy that worked pretty well. And the reason why things began to break down is because Russians went on the street in December of 2011, hundreds of thousands of them protesting against rigged elections and against Putin coming back to power. And Russia blamed us for that. And then we know what happened afterwards. They gave Edward Snowden asylum, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason why the relationship has gotten so bad is because of Putin's domestic issues. He now portrays the threat from the United States as the main reason why people should support him, and the great patriotism with annexing Crimea. So it's not that we haven't tried. But a lot of what's happened is because of what's happening inside Russia and domestically. But I also agree that obviously in something like Syria, the Russians were, you know, had a great opportunity. The Obama administration wasn't willing to engage more, and they stepped into the vacuum, and we see what they've done now.
Let's hear from another caller. This is Ed calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Ed, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Good.
Excellent. Hey, I just have a couple things to say. I just retired from the military. I was in Europe during the famed Russian reset. And in the service, we understood that this was a disaster. It's not how you deal with someone like Vladimir Putin. And to answer your question, as far as Hillary Clinton, if she became the next commander-in-chief president, I think it would be a disaster because she was one of the chief architects of this policy towards Russia that has led us into what is essentially a new Cold War. And just last thing I'd like to say is that we have to understand that your guests, Brookings Institute and Foreign Policy Magazine, that these are the types of folks that have been giving the advice to the current administration that has led us down this path. And if we listen to the discussion points that they're bringing up, we understand that the bias included in the hubris from our own government, led by the Ivy League folks, has led us to where we're at right now with Russia. It's very unfortunate. It could have been avoided completely.
Ed, thanks for that. Angela Stent, you're at the Brookings Institution. You're among the Ivy League folks he's talking about. Do you think that's fair criticism?
Well, I mean, I think what I would like to ask the caller is if it's a, you know, if it's a President Trump, I agree completely with what was said before that, I mean, from Putin's point of view, if he does indeed support Donald Trump becoming president, it's because he thinks America's weak and Donald Trump is going to be pliable. So that would lead presumably to a relationship where, you know, the U.S. would be doing much less and Russia could really do whatever it wanted.
You know, Cameron Abadi, you made a reference to the U.S. can't be negotiating with Russia from a position of weakness. Trump has said explicitly that he would only negotiate from a position of power, a position of strength. And, you know, Hillary Clinton has talked about Putin being someone who is basically a bully that you have to stand up to, because if you don't, he will take as much as he can. So both sides seem to acknowledge there has to be a relationship. It's a matter of, is there going to be enough force in that relationship? Cameron, your thoughts on whether the Clinton administration could be forceful enough?
I think that's the caller made the point as well that Hillary Clinton supported the reset policy. But it's worth pointing out that Hillary Clinton was known as probably one of the most skeptical of Russia within the Obama administration. And so there's reporting to suggest that Putin is not a fan of Hillary Clinton specifically, precisely because she would be a tougher negotiator, someone who is comfortable using force in places and in at times that Obama, the Obama administration, might not have been. So I think there's plenty of reason to think that Hillary Clinton would be willing to use force in order to be tough with Vladimir Putin.
Another piece of sound. This is an interview yesterday with CBS This Morning in which former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden says that he supports better relationship with Russia, just as Trump does. But he does say that there needs to be consequences for invading another country like Russia did to Ukraine.
I like the part about the Russian cooperation, right. But I do think actions have consequences. The occupation of Crimea, the continued occupation of portions of the Ukraine, the threat to the Baltics.
Angela Stent, is it clear that the Obama administration has known how to deal with that and that the Clinton administration would know how to deal with that kind of aggression?
I think so. I mean, first of all, you should read what Hillary Clinton says in her book about Vladimir Putin, really quite tough. And as we understand, there's really no, you know, from the Kremlin's point of view, there's no love lost between them and Hillary Clinton. So I think that she probably would be possibly a more interventionist president than President Obama has been in some of these issues. And, you know, we'll have to revisit issues like the supplying of lethal weapons to Ukraine, you know, if she becomes president. So I feel fully confident that she would be able to deal with that.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Martha calling from Wethersfield, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Martha.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Your thoughts about all this?
I just traveled to Russia in June, Krasnodar, Yalta, St. Petersburg, and Moscow with a citizens diplomacy group. And our purpose was to hear on the ground how Russians were feeling about the very recent deterioration of relations. And I think the general sentiment is that at least Donald Trump speaks the truth about how he feels, his opinions. He's honest about his opinions. And yes, there is a great fear that Clinton will, quote, comfortably use force. And those are very scary realities for the Russians. They also told us about a referendum that they had in February of 2014 in Yalta. And the turnout rate for the voting was very high. And there were reasons why they voted to go back to Russia. It was not an annexation. It was a reunification. That's the propaganda that we heard when we were there.
Martha, you said that they felt that Hillary Clinton would comfortably use force. They felt that they did not feel the same of Donald Trump?
Well, they said that Donald Trump is at least honest in what he says of his opinions, and he is analyzing NATO in a way. This is all very ironic. We don't have Bernie Sanders as a candidate. He is our best candidate, and that really needs to be examined. Donald Trump is certainly not a statesman. I don't know how he got in to be a candidate, but the Russians clearly understand that the current administration is playing a game of brinksmanship with nuclear weapons, and Russia is on the defensive. The United States is on the offensive, and this has to do with resources once again. Russian resources, capitalism playing its role, the U.S. using NATO to place missiles in the face of Russia. We need to talk about what Victoria Nuland said and did with this coup in the Ukraine. The honesty of the people on your show needs to be examined.
Martha, thanks for the call. Cameron Abadi, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would simply say that the possibility of conflict with Russia is not just a matter of who's sitting in the White House. As Angela Stent was saying, it's partly also a matter of the worldview of Vladimir Putin himself as someone who runs the Russian government. And as far as we know, Vladimir Putin believes that America is a threat to Russia and is an enemy of Russia and has been acting that way in terms of using his military. So I would question the assessment that Russia is always on the defensive. In fact, it seems in a lot of instances they have been on the offensive, with Ukraine being a notable example.
And Angela, you have maybe a 20-second thought before we take a brief pause?
Well, I obviously disagree. I would just like to ask the caller how her Russian interlocutors explain the fact that Russia began a war in eastern Ukraine in which more than 10,000 people have died, and they've still got troops there. They're fighting. They're killing Ukrainians. And Viktor Yanukovych was not deposed in a coup. He fled because his security detail abandoned him.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking today about the U.S.-Russia relationship and possible cyber meddling by Russia in the U.S. presidential election. You can join this conversation. Let us know if you think Russia is just an aggravating thorn in our side, or is it a more serious threat? And can you imagine Russia, through future email leaks, actually tipping the election to Donald Trump? We are still with Cameron Abadi, a senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine, and Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. And joining us now is Jarno Limnell. He is a professor of cybersecurity at Aalto University in Finland. He's also a former officer in the Finnish Defense Forces and author of Cybersecurity for Decision Makers. Jarno Limnell, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Sasha. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. So let's talk about the DNC hacking. We talked a bit at the beginning about the email hack. Let's listen to an interview with Fox News Sunday in which Hillary Clinton blamed Russian intelligence services for hacking the Democratic National Committee computer system, and she accused Donald Trump of supporting Putin.
We know that Russian intelligence services, which are part of the Russian government, which is under the firm control of Vladimir Putin, hacked into the DNC, and we know that they arranged for a lot of those emails to be released. And we know that Donald Trump has shown a very troubling willingness to back up Putin, to support Putin.
So there's Hillary Clinton saying very clearly that Russia is the hackers. But John Kerry was a little bit more nuanced here. He was at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit in Laos last week when he addressed that hack with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. Here's Kerry.
It's important for the FBI to do its work. And before we draw any conclusions in terms of what happened or who's behind it, it's very important that whatever public information is put out is based on fact.
Yarno Limnell, we have Hillary Clinton saying it was the Russians. We have John Kerry saying, well, maybe it wasn't the Russians. What do we know?
Well, actually, this is all speculation at the moment, and we are having a lot of that both in the United States and here in the Europe as well. There aren't any that kind of evidence that we could clearly say publicly that, yes, it was 100% sure Russia was behind it or any other actor behind this DNC hack or the leaks. And most probably, as I believe, we will not see that kind of evidence because that would mean that especially the United States intelligence community, they would be forced to reveal their sources and methods, how they obtained this information that it was actually Russia. So this will remain open for the speculation as long as we can see clear evidence. And listening today, actually, the Admiral Rogers, the chief of the NSA, he was very cautious to mention anything about the Russia and any attribution. But at the same time, I have to say that many people, for example, here in Europe, they are really waiting for that, hey, how you can solve this this incident, and especially how you will respond for this, because this will be very important precedent in the international system, how United States will respond if Russia was behind it.
And how? What is the correct response in your view?
Well, I think there will be both public and a covered response. Most probably, I believe that there will be some political pressure against Russia saying that, yes, this is very bad, you can't do this, let this be the last time. Most probably, I believe, if the Russian is behind it, there will be some economical sanctions, what has happened against the North Korea and, for example, China, and some maybe legal issues also. But then at the same time, I believe that there will be some covert actions done behind the scenes that we will actually not seeing. And I would not be surprised if, for example, in the coming months, there would be some leaks happening from the Russian government or from the Russian oligarchs to relieving some sensitive information concerning about them.
So you think we may not have seen the last of these leaks, at least in this presidential election cycle?
Not at all. There will be many, many surprises also in this front, in the cyber front and the cyber field when we are closing up to the November. But at the same time, I have to say that the positive outcome of this DNC hack has been that your candidates in the United States have been talking more actively about the Russians, about the situation. And I have been a little bit surprising before this incident that Russia has not been so big topic in your presidential elections, but now it seems that it is.
Yarno, we don't know for sure that the Russians hacked the emails, but we do know that WikiLeaks released them. Someone gave them to WikiLeaks. And in an interview with Meet the Press on Sunday, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, did not answer the host, Chuck Todd's, questions about whether Russia gave him the leaked DNC emails. Here's what Julian Assange said.
I do think it's an interesting question, of course, as to who our sources are. But as a source protection organization that many sources from across the world of many different types rely on to protect their identities and their right to communicate the truth to the public. And that's what we're talking about here.
Now, Yarnell, what's interesting here is that largely to this point, WikiLeaks has been viewed as a nonpartisan releaser of mass amounts of information. There is a view in some people's eyes that this information was deliberately released by WikiLeaks because Julian Assange is on the record not caring for Hillary Clinton. So in your view, is this a different type of WikiLeaks information release that is intended to have an agenda, whereas the others may have been agendaless?
Well, I think this is also a very interesting case here. Now we are talking about the WikiLeaks, but also many other sources who can be much bigger part of these kind of campaigns and these kind of leaks that what was the situation before the digital age in a way. But at the same time, I would really like to remind that when we are talking about the Russia especially here, we are talking about very unpredictable international actor, how they are behaving at the moment, acting actively and aggressively both in the physical environment and cyber domain, and this reality will remain in the coming years, and this will not change. And also, I think concerning about the WikiLeaks, I think it's very important to understand that the Russian government has been intentionally blurring the lines between cyber activities, these criminals, state-paid hackers. We know for pretty sure, for example, how we did the research concerning about the cyber warfare in the ongoing Ukraine war, how the Russians are outsourcing their cyber activities, for example, as cyber espionage campaigns to the proxy groups and the criminal groups. So using, for example, WikiLeaks to leak this kind of information, I think that fits very well in the larger picture of the Russian state-sponsored information operations and how they actually act in these kind of cases nowadays.
That's Yarnell Limnell. He's a professor of cybersecurity at Aalto University in Finland. Still with us are Cameron Abadi of Foreign Policy Magazine and Angela Stent of Georgetown University and the Brookings Institution. Cameron and Angela, we haven't talked yet about what Trump's possible business interests may be in Russia that would influence what he wants his relationship with Russia and Putin to be. I want to read to you a few Facebook comments we've gotten about that. One person, Liz May on Facebook, says, since Trump refuses to release his tax returns, it is impossible to answer any questions about his foreign business interests, isn't it? Now, it's not clear that his tax returns would necessarily tell us that, but that seems to be a fair point. Then we have another commenter on our website who brings up Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort. This is a man who had a lobbying firm he co-founded that was hired by the former Ukrainian president to improve his image in the West. And Josephine on our website writes, was specifically wondering about the public relations work done for the Ukrainian president. Another listener, Mr. Nutso, writes on the website, is Paul Manafort still receiving compensation from Ukrainian interests? And let's bring in a caller, John from Buffalo, New York, who has some thoughts about that as well. John, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call. First, it should be clear that Donald Trump doesn't have a clue of what he's talking about with respect to the Ukraine. Not a clue. He should just come out and say so. Also, the sympathies of his staff should also be clear. We have Paul Manafort, as you just mentioned, who'd been with Yanukovych right up to the end for the 2010 presidential campaign as well. And then you've got a guy named Carter Page, who was his foreign policy expert that is up to his ears in Gazprom, and making out quite well, thank you.
Gazprom, of course, the Russian oil company, that reference to Yanukovych as the former president of Ukraine. So you believe that the business interests or the business relationships Trump and his advisors may have are a factor here?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt, without even speaking of it, the alleged loans to Donald Trump that he refuses to talk about. Quite frankly, he is in Putin's pocket.
Angela,
that's my 2 cents for today.
John, thanks for that. Angela Stent, Trump has said he has no investments or debts in Russia, although he's acknowledged that he's been interested in doing deals there. You know, he's viewed the former Soviet Union as a huge investment opportunity. He was interested in putting a luxury hotel up across from the Kremlin. That didn't work out. What's your view of how his business interests or investments may be a factor here?
Well, he's certainly been trying to do business with Russia since Gorbachev was in power in 1988. When Gorbachev came to New York, Trump wanted to meet with him and his group to discuss business, but the American hosts, Gorbachev's American hosts, nixed that. They turned that down. As you say, he's unsuccessfully been trying to build, you know, Trump hotel properties and other things there. He did host the Miss Universe contest there a few years ago. So on the one hand, you can say he hasn't been successful in these kind of large projects there. On the other hand, we understand that a number of different Russians are invested in businesses that he has in this country. His son has said that. So there is certainly, there's a business interest there. But I think to draw the conclusion that his comments about Putin are only about business, that's maybe a leap too far. And I would just, but I would also agree that Paul Manafort has this long history of backing the now former disgraced president of Ukraine. But Manafort's company has certainly been involved in helping found a political party, support a political party in Ukraine that opposes the current government and that takes a more pro-Russian stance. So I think all those things have to be taken into account.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Brad calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Brad, welcome to On Point. And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I kind of see Putin and Trump as two peas in a pod. I think they're both power-hungry guys. And I think that Trump sees Putin as being lucky having being born in Russia and able to manipulate the press, the government, and the people. And I think that shows in Trump's attitude towards our Constitution and the little guy. And I think he'll do anything to be a lapdog for Putin because that's what he wants to be. He wants to be the emperor that tells everybody what to do. And that seems to be his the way he is. And I think that Putin looks at it like, yeah, let's get my lapdog in here because I'll be able to influence American politics any way I want.
Brad, thanks for that. Cameron Abadi, if Putin has that much vested interest in having Trump become president, do you think that we will see more actions by Russia in coming months intended to influence the presidential election in a way that would land Trump in the Oval Office?
Well, we certainly know that there are more emails that these allegedly Russian hackers have gotten their hands on that haven't been released. So I think it's safe to say that we will see more of those emails released, whether through WikiLeaks or through somebody else. We don't know what those emails contain, but there could be a bombshell among them that would influence the election. And more generally, it does seem that Putin is again, interested in would prefer that Trump win this election. And so why would he not make efforts at this point to have that outcome occur? He's already pretty far deep at this point, so there's no reason to turn back. Whether he has the ability to actually influence the election's outcome is another question. This is ultimately going to be an election decided by American voters. It's going to be in early November, and the Americans will go to the polls and vote. So Putin can't influence how individuals vote ultimately, but he will try, obviously.
Cameron, would you weigh in also on your thoughts on Trump's business interests or possible business interests or investments in Russia? Long before Trump was in politics, going back several years, he did say at one point that he wouldn't want to upset a Russian politician since he hoped to do business there in the future. What are your thoughts about that aspect of how he treats and approaches Russia and Putin?
Well, you know, there's, as always with Trump's politics and business interests, there's a lot of bluster. So it's hard to kind of get through all of the bluster that he says and what is actually his concrete business economic interests in Russia. What seems to be the case is that he relies on Russian investors to get some certain projects off the ground. At this point, he's gone through bankruptcy so many times that most banks won't actually support his business projects. So he can go to seemingly wealthy Russian investors to give him loans that banks won't. Otherwise, it seems that a lot of wealthy Russians purchase his apartments and homes and real estate in the United States, whether to sort of hide their ill-gotten gains that they've gotten in the corrupt Russian economy. That seems to be the basic relationship right now in terms of business that they have. But that first point is important because Trump can't really get financing otherwise. So he does kind of seem to be dependent on wealthy people around the world. And there are a lot of wealthy people in Russia right now.
Angela, Cameron raises the point of just how much can Putin really do? This election will be decided by U.S. voters. On the other hand, Putin can meddle in a way that makes it look like our democracy around the world, that we promote democracy around the world, but at home, the political elites determine who win, that we may have a double standard. How much damage do you think Putin can do if not swing an election?
Well, first of all, I agree completely with Cameron that we shouldn't exaggerate the ability of President Putin or people in the Kremlin to influence our own election. What the Russians want to do is, and they're doing this all around the world, or certainly in the West, is kind of relativize the question of, you know, who's a Democrat, who isn't. And so the Russian point is, you know, we complain about the Russians and what goes on there, dirty tricks and things like that. But look at what happens in your society. Look at the Democrats, if you're looking at the DNC League. Look how they're arguing with each other and trying to undermine Bernie Sanders. So I think the first point is, propaganda TV station Russia Today does, it's trying to undermine our belief in certain given truths about the strength of democracy in our society.
Got that. Thank you for that. That was Angela Stent, Cameron Abadi, and Yarno Limnell. Thanks to all of you for joining us. This is Sasha Pfeiffer. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.